welcome to Eyewitness Beauty, the podcast where we talk about the biggest stories of the beauty industry each and every week, and also the biggest stories in the beauty industry over 2 years ago. So that's what we're bringing you today. Think back to January 2021. It was the inauguration. Didn't January 6th happen then too? I'm pretty sure it did, right? January 6th, the insurrection, otherwise known as, aka January 6th, 2021. Oh yeah, that happened then too. So we were coming off, we were just coming off of the insurrection. We had Jenna Lyons on the pod, and that's what we're going to be playing today, is our interview with Jenna Lyons from January 2021, because Nick, of all people, podcast host Nick Axelrod Welk, has laryngitis, which precludes him from podcasting. So we're doing a re-release, but it's an interesting one because, as our dear producer Jonathan pointed out, Jenna actually said on this media outlet, Eyewitness Beauty, in January 2021, that she would never do Real Housewives. We all know what happened after that. She also talked about the best advice that Anna Wintour gave her, or she said that Anna Wintour gives the best advice. I actually met Jenna for the first time when she was at J. Crew, and she was my first ever top shelf interview that I did for Into the Gloss. It was Emily took me with her, and Jenna was so, she was funny from day one. She had like an old label maker, and she made me a label. So that's my story. It was actually at our office instead of our home. But then I got to visit her home too at some point, because we did a photo shoot with her for Glossier years later. She had a sick apartment with like Cy Twombly everywhere and a fur bedspread and a very well done, well appointed marble bathroom with incredible fixtures. So anyway, Jenna Lyon, I think comfortably friend of the pod, Jenna Lyons, we thank you for being on this pod so very long ago, and I hope you guys enjoy this episode if you haven't heard it yet.
This was one of the biggest gets at Into the Gloss, an icon of style and also, I think, of beauty. Jenna Lyons, who was the president of J. Crew, she was at J. Crew for 27 years, and then she left in 2019 and has now created a fake eyelash brand called Love Scene. She has a show on HBO that's sort of like a docuseries / reality show. She's making moves. She is awesome.
Yeah. For someone as powerful and like storied as she is and has been made out to be, she name drops Anna Wintour like it's like nothing. And she's so kind and so welcoming. I think hers was the first top shelf interview I went on, and I've worked with her just a couple of times over the years. We shot her for a Glossier campaign, and she was just so down to collaborate. And
this is someone who at a certain point at J. Crew had 600 people under her.
It's insane. And her energy level is so insane, which is why she's able to do so much. You'll hear her talk in the episode around like about all the different projects and companies that she has going on at one time. But I think this interview, you know, we talk about beauty. Of course, we are a beauty podcast, but my favorite part was talking with her about her career and how she has maneuvered life after J. Crew. I think you had like a really great question on, you know, you've been in a brand for so long that in a way like kind of defines who you are as a person.
How do you move forward when you're not Jenna from J. Crew? So here's our interview. You and Annie have met in person. I've never met you.
We go way back. We first met in 2014. So I came to do your top shelf interview for Into the Gloss.
I remember. But your hair is so long and luxuriated now. Look at you.
Oh, my COVID hair. It gets caught in my jeans now.
Ooh, Crystal Gayle vibes.
Okay, I have to Google.
You don't even know who that is? Okay, I get to call you baby.
Okay, that's fine. I'll take it. But I remember like coming to ask your place. I was so nervous because you were like the biggest interview that I'd done at that point.
No
And
way.
I didn't really do the interview. I was kind of like just in the room. But you were Aww. Very nice.
To early Into the Gloss, I would say you, Michelle Lamy, and maybe just you two were like kind of the ultimate gets for like what in terms of a top shelf. Yeah. Like the ultimate.
Wow. I mean,
and Michelle, like, we could never, Michelle, we couldn't really access. The like finally landing the Jenna Lyons interview was like a big day for Into the Gloss.
Listen, I'm so flattered. Little did you know that I would literally end up not doing anything, but I'm so flattered. That's so sweet. Thank you. It was fun for me. It was so nice.
I think the edit test that we had our intern that we hired, Nick, before you left do was editing like a fake Jenna Lyons Top Shelf. We were like trying to manifest it.
Oh my God, that is so sweet. I love it. It's so interesting how like small the world is and how things go around. And then since then you've started a business and you guys are like grooving and Glossier is doing incredibly well. And I really don't have a job.
We were so excited to talk to you, number one. Number two, personally, I need an answer selfishly, which is when I left Into the Gloss, I had like a total identity crisis because I had sort of become, the way that I like described it to my therapist, like I had become, you know, Nick from Into the Gloss to everyone. Mm-hmm. And Into the Gloss was this really fucking cool thing. It was very like hot at the moment. And then one day I was Nick from Into the Gloss. And the next day I wasn't, you know, not to over dramatize it, but it was super traumatic. And it took me a long time to sort of disentangle, you know, my identity, like who am I professionally? Who am I, like, what's my social capital? If I'm not Nick from Into the Gloss, if I'm not, you know, Nick from part of this thing. And I know you were at J. Crew for 26 years and then not part of J. Crew, you were the face of this thing. What happened sort of like the day after?
I appreciate you being honest and open about it because I think a lot of people are surprised. For some reason, it feels very hard for a lot of people to talk about. And I think it's nice that you're open about it. I named my new sort of parent company that sort of sits a Lyons LAD, which is Lyons Life After Death, because it really did feel like a part of my life had sort of died. I struggled. The other thing that you can't possibly imagine or I didn't realize is that my whole life kind of went away. I had assistants who took care of everything, had someone who managed my personal life, someone who managed my professional life, someone who managed all of my PR and press. Like, I barely knew how to send an attachment. I mean, it was kind of crazy because I had come up in the world when computers, like, I didn't have a computer when I first started at J. Crew. Designers didn't have them. We sketched everything by hand. We wrote faxes by hand. We communicated via phone. And I started to get more senior at a time when computers started to get given to the design team. And so I never had one. I had one, but I used it for email. And I really missed that whole tier of education and communication.
Like the digitization of design.
It passed me by. And not just design, because we never went to digital design ever. We were drawing until the day I left. It was more just the way people communicated. And I mean, like, I can't do an Excel spreadsheet. Like, I don't know how to do that. Someone else took care of my bills. Like all that stuff. I was sort of, so there was this part of me that was connected from, you know, as you said, a social capital, like, who am I? Like the invitation stuff coming. I didn't get invited to anything anymore. I was really alone and it felt really kind of dark, but it was, I think, probably the best thing that could have happened to me. You can believe your own hype and, you know, it feels nice when you pick up the phone and you call someone, I'm Jenna Lyons from J. Crew, and you get what you want most of the time. You know, people will pick up the phone, they'll take your call. And that's a really privileged perspective and place to sit. And it's really healthy to not have it. And it's really humbling.
Yeah. What helped you sort of like adjust to life post?
I felt really bad and really upset for a long time that I didn't get a lot of phone calls because I really thought, oh, I'll get another job. It'll be fine. And that didn't happen. Nobody called. And, you know, I think that's a really weird thing to experience, to be someone.
And people are probably always like, your friends are always saying, oh, you must be getting calls all the time, off the phone's running off the hook. And yeah.
Everyone said that. The number of people are like, oh, don't worry, the phone call, it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some people thought that I was locked up, which I was to a certain extent. I couldn't necessarily take another job right away. But what I think I didn't realize is the impact on my ego and my personal state. However, like I said, it was the best thing that happened to me because it made me take other conversations I never would have had. I would never have started another business. I never would have done a TV show. And maybe those were terrible ideas, but I'm happy I did them because I had an incredible experience doing that. And, you know, I'm working on a hotel and like I get to do things I probably would never have taken the chance to do because nothing else happened. And I also felt really disconnected from the fashion world when I left because it disconnected from me. I, you know, and I could have made a deeper effort. Don't get me wrong. It's not a pity party. It's not like I needed somebody to say, hey, come play with us. I was quiet myself, but it was a gift, a fucking gift. It was the hardest gift I've ever had to receive, but I'm happy it happened.
Well, is there a reason that you didn't kind of re-engage in the fashion world as opposed to starting a new like chapter in the beauty space?
I know this is going to sound like a really lame answer and probably like somewhat disbelief, but like by the time I realized what was happening, like meaning I was taking calls for random people, people that had nothing to do with the fashion industry. Like my friend Susie called and said, do you want to do a line of furniture? And that evolved into doing a hotel. And I took another call from a friend who was like, my friend wants to talk to you about a TV show. And I'm like, I don't want to do it, but I'll like buy me a free lunch and I'll come. And that turned into me doing a TV show. And before I really realized what was happening, I was doing these other things and I thought they would all fall away and they didn't. And I couldn't believe it. I still kind of can't believe it. I know it sounds weird that I should have like I sat around and waited for it to come, but I don't even know where to start. You know, I definitely put the word out and I called my favorite headhunter who I know, this woman, Karen Harvey. And I was like, hey, I'm back in the market. And everyone knew I was back in the market.
It was almost in like a tricky situation in which you were so big in the fashion world that like there were only a certain, like there's Celine, like where are you going to go? Like that's bigger or more important. You know, people thought they probably couldn't afford you, that you wouldn't do it, that it would seem publicly, like optically, like a step down or something.
I think that all of those things are honestly kind of true. I also think my name was so synonymous with other brands that if you have a brand, unless the person who's there is gone. So for instance, like I would have loved Don Ralph, but Ralph still exists and he's still around. He doesn't want somebody like me coming along because there's a different connotation. And I didn't really want to do Banana Republic or The Gap. Like I felt like that would just be the same thing I'd already done. And so I didn't really have a lot of options. Like I really thought about like, what would I do? And I remember talking to Anna Wintour about it. And she said to me, she's like, you shouldn't do fashion, just do TV. Now this was before the TV show happened. I don't know how she figured that one out, but we'd been doing the Vogue Fashion Fund together and it was on TV for a while. And she's like, you know, I think you excel at that. You should do that. I was like, really? She's smart, that woman.
She knew like where to kind of place you, like what medium.
I think she's much more of a puppet master than any of us realize. I think she's got a lot of tendrils and understands how things work behind the scenes and is very intuitive in that way.
I feel like she's known for that, right?
Oh, totally. She has a unique position. She knows every single designer. She knows every single owner of all of the houses. She knows who's talented. She knows where they've been. She knows what their skill set is. She's met them. She's seen what they're capable of. She's seen the trajectory of their career. She knows the entire landscape. That's a pretty unique position to sit in.
She's like a stock trader. She's like seen like patterns happen so many times over like the totally. Decades and decades she's been doing it. She could probably place you in a way that like a lot of other people couldn't.
I agree completely.
The other thing I was curious about is, you know, you seem to be an incredibly creative person, you know, someone who would just like have like the most amazing mood boards, like in their office and like fabric swatches and all this stuff. But having very briefly for very short amounts of time worked in corporate, I know that it can suck the creativity out of you. You know, you have to be a certain type of person to be able to like understand how to play the game. And you obviously figured out how to thrive in that environment. And now you're doing freelancing and startups, which is totally different.
Well, thank you. It was 27 years. Don't get rid of me. I mean, I think you're right. It is really hard. And I will say I am deeply, deeply appreciative. You know, I'm Mickey Drexler, who I worked with, was so supportive of creative. And it is unusual to find that level of support and reference for creativity.
Do you like protect you from the corporate bullshit?
No, there is no way to kind of not play. You can't have it both ways. You need to be able to understand and see both sides. But what I think he did do, which I'm deeply appreciative of, is he put it on the same level as the business. So he said, by making the president of the company, he was saying, I believe that creativity is paramount to the business doing well, is paramount to the health of the brand. And it's just as important as the money. He believed those two things were synonymous. And I think by making that statement, it really did help me be able to manage my own course through the bullshit. You know, I mean, when I say bullshit, I mean just, you know, it's just like budget meetings and all of the hard stuff that you don't want to talk about. You know, at one point I had over 600 people reporting into me and like—
Is that 600 like performance development plans you had to sign off on?
I had like 14 direct reports. So 14 direct reports is 14 reviews and all that sort of stuff. That stuff eats you alive. It is a lot. And of course, everyone wants to do well. Everyone wants a raise. Everyone wants to move up. Everyone wants to get promoted. And it's like, of course, I get it. Like everyone wants to continue to grow. Of course, but when you're managing that many people, it's like, it's just, it takes a lot of bandwidth and energy and mental adrenaline to kind of keep going with all of that. And it does take away from just dreaming a little bit. I mean, I think that's the biggest pleasure I've had of not having a big job is to dream and like to come up with ideas and be creative. It's harder to do that when you're thinking about the health of a massive organization.
What percentage of your day, year, week, however you would want to think about it, would be business stuff? And what percentage would be like actual creative inspo stuff?
So hard to answer that question because I think I think that's what was so interesting, is that to me, the creativity drove the business. So it's, in other words, I don't think you ever stop. It's not that when the day is over at 6 o'clock, I stop thinking about something. It's like, oh, I might be looking at a website and think, oh, wow, it's really interesting that this website allows you to check out and they add a couple of different things onto your cart. And this actually made my experience better. And it made me see that that top actually works really well with that jacket or whatever. And it's like, oh, that's a great idea. I wonder if we could do that. You don't really separate or stop. It's not so cut and dry. I do think it ebbed and flowed for sure. I think the personnel part is the hardest part. It's the people stuff, of keeping people motivated, feeling good. It's so hard. It's the hardest part for me now. You feel stretched, and then like, are you taking care of your team? It's like, oh, so hard. What are you doing now?
I'm consulting. I'm working with a few incubators, developing new brands. It's funny, like the hardest thing always for me in Into the Gloss and in Necessaire was the personnel stuff, because it's not something that you take a class in if you don't go to business school. I don't even know if they offer that in business school, but I didn't go to business school. And it's something that can feel in the moment like beside the point, where like you have so many things to do. Like not only do you have to like, you know, do something for the investors, do something to drive the business, like do all, you know, do the photo shoot, do the this, do the that, you know, send out the package, but you also have to like take out the trash and like, you know, all the things you're doing. And then if someone seems like they're like a little upset or like having a bad day, like to say, okay, I need to spend an hour to take this, to stop everything, you know, and take this person out to coffee because they're clearly having a bad day. It takes experience to know, wait, like that person's energy is going to affect everyone's energy. So it's better to nip it in the bud. But I always found that the most challenging is making the time and prioritizing people management.
Yeah. And imagine having that on a massive scale. It's like, there's always an upset apple cart. It's just inevitable. And
that's why I'm wondering, like, was a lot of your time taken up, not taken up in a bad way, but just consumed by the management piece?
I mean, yes. And again, it is, as you said, it has a massive ripple effect. It can impact the quality of the creativity of the interactions between people and the quality of the decisions that they're able to make based on how they're feeling with each other, all of that. It is, as you said, it's the single biggest challenge. And it's also the thing that nobody teaches you, and it only comes with experience.
Yeah.
And there's no real way, like there's no shortcut to learning that. And again, like I said, I still get it wrong. I still struggle. And now we're doing it in COVID, which is like a whole other shit show. Like try hiring a team and then managing them with a text message. I mean, it's like insane. It doesn't work. It's like,
and you have to think, like, on top of all of the kind of life stressors that any person could be going through, that you've kind of hopefully learned to deal with in some way throughout your entire career as like managing people or whatever. Now it's like our whole world seems to be crumbling around us. So you have to keep that in your mind. You're like, wait, do we need to like take stock here? And maybe like everybody needs to like work a little bit slower and be a little bit more, I don't know, softer with each other, because we're going through probably the most insane time in like world history, in modern world history.
True. I think what we forget is, you know, we don't get to spend any time together. I was having a conversation, my assistant who was with me for 13 years, I was just saying, oh, I have a new person working with me. And we were talking about like, we don't get to spend any time together. Nicole was sitting on the other side of a wall, which was only a half wall. So she heard every single conversation in my office. She always knew if someone came into my office and left and they were happy, or she saw if they left and they were sad. She understood the temperature of the entire ecosystem. And she also knew every single project I was working on and who connected to that project and who was running the project. She just through osmosis was able to really understand and see what's going on. And that's the part that is really killing me now, is just scaling up and getting people assimilated. Is like, I mean, we have a social media person who I absolutely adore, who works on Love Scene. I have been in the same room with that person 3 times. I mean, we hired him on a Zoom call and I couldn't even see him. He was literally a black square because I was out at the beach and I did not have any reception. And I'm literally looking at a square. There's a lot that happens with someone talking to you, with their smile and whether they give you eye contact. You know, that stuff is really helpful. And so it's weird to be hiring people behind a screen.
Speaking of which, how did you go about setting up the business? I guess you were in all those, as the president, like you're in all those meetings about numbers and
so, you know, different
stuff.
The experiences that I had that served me also tripped me up. And the reason I say that is that my expectations of the way something would be done, I'm not used to scrappy. I'm used to getting stuff done, maybe with not all of the components, but I had people I could call on for any number of things. And oftentimes they were specialized. But here we have, you know, 7 people, and the same people who are interviewing people for our 3PL is the same person that's setting up the website, is interviewing the person who's doing the development, is the same person that's dealing with our packaging, is the same, you know, that's one person. Then we have one person who's project managing and following the flow of everything. Then we have someone who's designing the website, but also designing the packaging, working with the developer, like coming to on the photo shoot, working with the retoucher, and
it's all hands on deck.
Everyone's doing multiple things. Whereas in my previous life, we would have had someone who did copy, someone who did graphic design, someone who worked on the website. They're all different jobs. And so I was fumbling a little bit, you know?
I bet what's helpful though is the understanding of corporate, whatever, what's the tree where like the family
org
tree?
Chart?
Org chart. Understanding that and really wrapping your head around like what a role is, because you've had to like, you know, approve job descriptions and all that sort of stuff so many times, like it must be helpful when you're setting the foundation.
I think the most relative is the process. I remember really distinctly when we were filming the show and someone was like, well, can't you just tell them to, like, if you're thinking about a brand name, have somebody do some logos for you and just put them in front of you. And I'm like, but you don't do that. You have to get the name. Then you actually clear it with legal first, because you don't, there's no reason to go out and make a name and then do all the graphic design and then find out that you can't use that name. There's just a process. And so understanding the process of how things get done and how early copy and voice has to get developed. And I knew that. And that was super helpful. Also understanding how to work with production people and say, well, no, this is what I want. This is the steps I want, having fittings and really trying things and perfecting them and the level of detail that you need to give a factory and how to speak with them. And that kind of stuff was really, really helpful.
Is your umbrella company, it's Jenna Lyons After Death, Lyons After Death?
Sounds like you said Out for Death.
I like that too. It's even more aggressive.
We had to change it because that was for me. So that's like a pass-through because I have so many different projects going on.
That's a what?
It's a pass-through. I didn't know what that is.
I've heard of it, but I don't know what it is.
I can explain for anyone who is interested. So I have so many different projects. And so in order to manage the finances of those different projects, I have basically it's a pass-through company based. So I can bring all the finances in and then pay people out of that, because not everyone works on every project. So like the hotel project is one team, Love Scene sits over here. I'm also working on a furniture thing, and I'm also working on a consulting business for Rockefeller Center. And so that allows me to have all of the money come into one place.
Right. So that's like the bigger organization.
Yes. However, because I have so many other projects, and there's other projects that I cannot mention that are percolating right now, we're creating like a creative agency that's called Sort of Creative, because that's, we're sort of creative. I like to say that I'm sort of creative, and we're going to bucket everything in there because it's getting too complicated. And I'm not making it any clearer by telling you that, but that is what's happening.
So Love Scene is the fake lashes brand.
Is the fake lashes, which I'm wearing now. Can you see?
Oh my God, oh, yeah. They're really pretty.
Thank you.
I don't understand fake lashes, actually. How long do they last? Do you have to take them off every night?
You do. I mean, if you're like bad, like, I mean, in some of my like earlier days, party nights, I might not have taken them off. So you can wear them as many times as you want if you don't put a lot of makeup on. If you put a lot of makeup on, makeup and mascara in particular degrades them. And also it's when you take it off, they're delicate. So like you have to be really careful. I don't put mascara on mine because I don't really want that look. So I can wear them, you know, like 7-8 times, but I don't use a lot of glue either. And I just don't wear a lot of makeup. So if you put a lot of mascara on, you'll probably get like 3 or 4.
And they don't hit your glasses?
No, these aren't long. Ours are pretty delicate. That was the whole idea, is that I don't have any eyelashes. And so I was noticing all the women in my office, when I could always tell when someone was getting married, because they come in with like eyelash extensions.
Oh, the extensions.
Oh my God. And they were like, literally they would arrive in the room before they did. I was like, oh, there are the eyelashes. And then like, I don't know if you ever watched like Huda Beauty. Have you ever seen Huda Beauty?
Oh, yeah.
So all of those girls who are putting on like 7 layers of like contour and highlighter and foundation, and then at the very end they plop on an eyelash. I'm like, that's so weird. Like these women at J.Crew who are wearing no makeup at all, and then these Huda Beauty girls who are like, and an eyelash. And I thought that was interesting, that two opposite ends of the spectrum of people are wanting the same volume in their eyes, but there wasn't anything in between. And so our lashes are made for people who want to wear them like on a daily basis and don't want them to be so big. And so I'm wearing the iris, and it's pretty, like, it's chill looking.
They're like the no makeup, makeup false lashes.
Yes. Right. Thank you. You could do it at PSA class.
I could build a beauty brand.
You could. I'm sure you could. You are a beautiful girl and you have a lot of knowledge. You are the perfect person to do it. I mean, I probably shouldn't be doing it, but I did it anyway.
I was an editor at Elle, and then I went into the gloss, and so went into beauty. And I think beauty people and fashion people are very different.
Oh my God, yes.
You know, at the time, fashion people, they were snobby about beauty, because beauty people, at least in the magazine world, were the ones who were kind of like almost on the ad side, because they were like having to do stories for, you know, all the big advertisers that paid for the entire magazine.
That pays for most of the magazines. It's ironic. Exactly.
It was like kind of the dirty secret of magazines, because the glamour and the glitz was the cover shoots and the well stories. And that was all the fashion stuff. So the beauty people were oftentimes super, super intelligent. You have to have a really good sense of science to be in beauty, at least on the media side. And then in general, besides you, I don't know a ton of people who can make a lot of money in fashion. It's a glamorous industry, but at the end of the day, it's hard to make it work. And beauty, like, the margins are better than fashion. Like, it's a better business. There's more exits, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it just kind of attracts a different kind of person. What do you find the differences?
I mean, there are so many differences. So I'll say two things. Beauty is about providing a service and providing a product, because at the end of the day, all of us, you could wear the same eyelash I wear, Annie and I could wear the same lipstick, but we will still be us. And you are not necessarily changing me in any way. You're not giving me something to empower me or look different than I am, other than feeling more beautiful with what I've got. Whereas fashion is transformative. Fashion can literally say a lot about who you are by putting on a single dress. And I think that they are two really different forms of communication, and the people who do them have different desires. I loved making clothes. It is a very different experience, because what you're getting to do is really touching someone in a really deep way, and it can be really transformative. And for anyone who's ever put on a beautiful suit or an incredible dress and walked out of their room feeling great, and not that having a beautiful face, you know, having someone put your makeup on can't do that, but it's very hard giving someone a product to create that experience for them. And that is a huge driver. It drove me for years. I loved that experience. It is, as you said, it's a totally different landscape. What I do love about beauty is that part of what I struggled with in my job, particularly at the end, was that I felt like I was always disappointing someone. When you are making clothing for people, you know, I'm 6 feet tall and don't have any boobs. And the same thing that is going to fit beyond me is going to get graded down to a size two. And that thing, that person, size two person, might be really curvy and have gigantic knockers. And the idea that we're going to wear the same thing and it's just going to be graded up or down is really hard. And so one of us is probably going to be disappointed. And that was happening more and more. And I think it was getting harder and harder to really make people feel happy. And with makeup, it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what color your skin is. It doesn't matter whether you're a size 44, 22, 8, or 0. You can play. And everyone is allowed in, whether you're a boy or a girl, you're trans, everyone is allowed. It's a different level of servicing a customer. And that is what's easier. I can make lashes and anyone can wear them. And that's really rewarding. And that barrier of like having a connection with somebody is way, way lower. I still really miss playing with sparkly shit and like tulle and stuff. Like, really, for a gay lady, it's really surprising. I know, but it's like my favorite thing on the planet.
You, it's funny. You like, your eyes like did light up when you were talking about fashion. And like, as someone who never really bought into fashion, even when I was in it, like, and I really bought into beauty, I kind of felt the opposite. I could go on and on about how transformative beauty is and how it allows you to like access designer or a lifestyle or something that like fashion felt more exclusionary. Beauty felt more inclusive.
I think you're talking about it though from the user experience. I'm talking about it from the producer or the designer. So as a designer, there's something really magical about knowing that you can transform someone to make them that. And like, you can't get the same thing from like a lipstick or an eyelash can be great, but you still need the rest of it. And also you in the connection. So for instance, I don't know if you're wearing eyelashes from far away unless I really come and look, or if we made a lipstick, I wouldn't know if you were wearing it. Whereas I remember walking through airports and seeing people wearing our double cloth coat. And like, I was so excited. It felt really good. Or the Obama girls wearing or something, you know, it's like, that is really tangible, very connected. You can connect to yourself and to other people. It's really different. And it's hard to know with beauty. And obviously you can see it through people purchasing your product, but you don't have that like recognition.
I feel like though, the more your brand grows and the more customers that you get and the more like reviews you start getting online, people are going to be reaching out to you, telling you how like these lashes have like changed their life. You're going to see, I think, that coming in on a more like intimate, straight to your inbox, straight to your DMs basis. Everything you're saying about fashion, it's like, I've never thought that about fashion because I've never worked in fashion, but it makes perfect sense. on the beauty side, it's like that happens so like, especially online, like I wouldn't know what beauty marketing or like growing an audience was like pre-digital, but there's so much of that in the beauty community online. It's like insane.
I'm excited. I'm still new. I feel like a new kid on the block, which is weird being my age to feel new.
The other thing I was thinking about in fashion that's just very different is there's this whole social aspect to it and the nightlife and the glitz and the glamour and the parties. And, you know, I guess there are like a lot of press days for beauty brands, but it's not at the same, there's not a Met Ball for
my
beauty.
Worst nightmare.
but you were totally a staple of that world and that scene. And that's something that even fashion now doesn't, it kind of, you know, fizzled with a lot of different industry trends, but like, do you miss it?
I'm so happy I got to do it, but I can honestly say no, I miss the people. You know, with every event comes the next day of people looking at themselves and like, did I get picked? Did anybody take my picture? And like, there is a tremendous amount of pressure that you can't really see. And, you know, I'll never forget the first time I went to the Met Ball. So this is something that you don't know, but the way that the Met Ball is done is they give out tickets and you can tell whether you're important enough based on the time that you get.
So, everything in fashion is so, it's
also, they had to schedule people so that.
Yes, it but it's like fashion shows. It's like, sure, everyone can see, but if you're not in the front row, like you better go fuck yourself.
And listen, again, you can't have everybody arriving at the same time. So there is some coordination, but basically, so I have two really unusual experiences. The first time I got a super early time slot, which is fine. No, I was honored to be there, but it was the year that it was the Alexander McQueen show, you know, and he passed away. And the woman who had taken over, Sarah, was literally right in front of me. People were screaming my name. And I was like, oh my God. And then I realized that they were asking me to get out of the way. I was dying.
Humbling.
So that was the first time that I went to Met Ball. And then probably 5 years later, I was really late. Something had happened. I don't even remember what happened, but I think it was, I was borrowing jewels or something. And something had happened getting them late because we had security, blah, blah, blah. And Beyonce had done this thing where she basically would arrive late because then she would have the red carpet to herself. It's me on the red carpet and Beyonce. There's no one else. I mean, I could have literally dropped trowel, taken my shirt off. No one would have given a shit. I don't think anybody took a single picture of me. It was hysterical. No one even cared that I was there. I was like, okay, I'm just going to go. That was just the most embarrassing thing I've ever experienced, but like all very humbling.
I find that hard to believe because I feel like you were the coolest girl in fashion. Like fashion is very clicky and you were like the it girl.
No, I wasn't. Oh my God. Sweetheart, what are you reading? I do not know. I mean, I don't know what you're talking. No, I mean, I was so not at all. Thank you for saying that. That's so.
You literally invented a whole category of dressing, like the pajama, like dressing.
I don't know if I could take credit for that, but I'll take it.
I don't, well, they gave you credit for it. So you
know, I get credit for a lot of things that I really did not do. That is really nice of you to say. It's really not the way it was, but it is a lot of pressure either way. I live on Mercer Street. The Mercer Hotel is right up on the corner and there's constantly photographers there, particularly when the Kardashians are staying there. And so I will never forget. I was walking down the street and I literally like, it looks like I'm picking my nose. I might actually have been picking my nose. God only knows. I don't know. And there's a picture of me walking down the street and like, I mean, it was not a good look. And I could not believe that picture ended up somewhere. Someone sent it to me, my assistant. I don't even remember. And I was like, God, this is hot. Definitely had its moments, but then it has not so great moments either. Like the time that I was getting rash cream for everyone after a horrible visit to an awful place called Atlantis. Don't ever go there.
Oh God, yeah.
Everyone in the family had rashes and I was literally at Duane Reade at like crack of ass. I had every cream, like all these like gross things in my basket. And someone said, are you Jenna Lyons? And I was like, no, I get that a lot.
There's just times when you like have condoms or, you know, lube or toilet paper. You don't really want to run into anyone.
You know what? Like, yeah, like not right now.
I feel like also having now done a TV show, TV reaches a totally different / new audience that even fashion or, you know, beauty doesn't. Just because it's consumers of just TV who may not care about fashion or beauty. What has it been like to be in that world?
Well, I mean, I think it's so different. I don't know because of COVID. Like we had no wrap party. We had no launch party. You know, people can't see me. I'm wearing a mask and glasses and it's so weird. And it'll be interesting to see if there is a second season, if the world comes back, what it will feel like. But right now, I don't know. It's so strange. You know, the difference is, and you said it earlier, Annie, is like, the landscape has changed. Like now there's social media. It didn't exist when I was coming up in the world. So now people have a direct access to you and they do DM, but I can't possibly manage it. But people are nice. It's so cool.
I was talking to a friend about your show and my friend really loves the show. And she was saying one of the things that I find the most impressive and like special is the way that Jenna delivers feedback. And I was reading an interview you gave that also sort of touched on this idea that you have like a special ability to deliver criticism and or compliments in a package that feels good.
I try. I'm sure that I don't always. So
I try. Is that just something that you've always been good at?
No. I mean, I think first of all, I'm not always good at it. I really try. I learned one really important lesson once years ago where I was a new boss. I'd been promoted over some people and I made the assumption, like I had been in a situation where I had somebody who I had reported to and they would do this thing that drove me a little bit crazy where they were like, can you make it a little bit more like this and a little bit less like this, but never really telling me, which of course made me work harder. But I felt like, God, if you're not liking what I'm showing you, can you just be clear about what you do want? I'll go off and do 10 of what you do want. I'll do everything I can to get it right, but I would love a little bit more clarity. And so that was where I was coming from. And then when I became a new boss, I felt badly when I was like giving someone direction or changing something that they had done. And I remember really distinctly, I overstepped and said to this girl who was working on something that I'd asked her to do, I'm like, oh, well, I'll stay and help you do it. And by staying and helping her do it, I made her feel like she couldn't do it herself. And that actually didn't work. She felt like sort of diminished by me saying, oh, I'll stay and help you, because she felt like it meant I didn't trust her judgment and couldn't do it. And I was like, that never occurred to me. And she sat me down and told me that. And I was like, thank you. Good feedback. I'm really happy that you told me that. And there's been moments like that in my career where people have like given me real feedback and said, hey, this doesn't work. And I've tried really hard to listen to that. And the same thing, it's like when I've given someone feedback and said, I don't like that, or I don't think that works. And I don't say what does work, or here's what I think is working. This is helpful. It's easier to hear when you say to somebody, I don't think that's working, but you don't say, here's the two things I think are working, or you're not specific about why it's not working. It just leaves people feeling just like they just kind of disintegrate. It's not going to motivate them to go back to their desk and work harder. They're just going to be like, fuck that, you know? And so I've had a lot of training by people that have worked for me.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important. And being approachable enough for someone to come to you and say, hey, can we talk? That doesn't feel good. It doesn't work. I need different guidance. That's a huge part of growth. And as you said, like there's no training, there's no school, no one teaches you. You kind of learn it by trial and error. And I made a lot of errors. That's for sure.
And but when you're doing that, even on reality TV, I guess it's sort of like on the border of reality and docuseries.
Yeah, we try.
But were you ever asked to, do you have to like turn it up? Like, you know, turn up the drama, like really get in there, like really rip him apart. For this, let's do one more take, Jenna, but we're going to really just like give it, just rip it off.
Definitely. It was the hardest part of the process. We set out to make a show that was a combination of reality and documentary. And I said, I don't want to be a reality star in the way that reality is currently exhibited. I'm not that person. I can't do it. And I don't want to make people cry.
Oh my God. Have you, by the way, ever been approached to be on The Real Housewives of New York City?
No, there is nothing about me that would, I mean, I'm gay and I don't have big boobs. And like,
that sounds like a great storyline to me. No, but I mean, there were Carol Radiswill. Like there were, you know,
I love Carol.
I feel like Carol.
She's my favorite.
I feel like Andy like would have at least tried.
I love Andy. Can we just talk about Andy and Anderson? Did you watch the ball drop? Did you watch that?
Oh my God,
that?
They were so drunk.
I was dying. It was the sweetest thing I've ever seen. Anderson Cooper like giggling in the back. I mean, I died. Every time they took another shot, I'm like, yeah.
I just miss Kathy. It made me miss Kathy Griffin a little bit, though.
Oh, I do. I love Kathy.
Well, hold on. But sorry, you were saying about turning up the drama for reality TV.
Yeah. And I think there was desire for that, for sure. It was a conversation that was had. I had it at the very beginning when we started. And I was also an executive producer on the show. And it was my name. So it wasn't like I was stepping into a project that was pre-existing, like a Housewives or Project Runway, where there was a tone that was already set. It was my job and my responsibility to myself to set the tone and to say, like, that's not okay with me. I wouldn't do that. I would never say that. There was that. And I will say the network and the team were amazing. But, you know, we had some backdoor moments of like, nope, can't do that. I won't say that. You know, well, tell her how you really feel. And I'm like, that is how I really feel. I don't know. It was, yeah, there were definitely some moments. I probably cried more than anybody else.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's hard. weird. I'd never done it before. And I didn't want to make a fool of myself. I was protective of myself and the people, you know, they're making a television show. They have a job to do. And in real time with the camera rolling on you, being able to navigate what you don't see is behind the scenes where someone throwing a line at you and say like, well, ask them why they thought of doing that or why they thought that was a good idea. And I'm like, okay, if I answer that or say that the way you just said it, I'm going to seem, so how do I say that in my own words that respects the person and gets the message across?
It's a lot of pressure.
You're doing that while the camera is rolling and you're exhausted. You've been up since six. You don't get a lot of breaks. You have a mic strapped to you at all times. It's real and it is exhausting. And we were working 12 to 14 hour days and you're just on the entire time. And I have to take ownership. Oh yeah, I cried a lot.
But you would do a season two if it gets picked up again.
I mean, what? I don't know. Yes. I mean, maybe. I don't know.
It wasn't traumatic enough for you to say, I'm never doing that again.
It was not traumatic enough. No, definitely not. I mean, I want to, I think. I don't know if I'd do it exactly the same way.
Jenna, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you. It was fun. You guys were awesome.
This is so fun. And people can find you on Instagram since the year 2020. You joined.
There I am. And don't feel bad if I don't DM you back.
You are at Jenna Lyons NYC. And Love Scene are your lashes.
Yes. And then the show is at Stylish. Wait, is the show at HBO? Uh-oh. It doesn't have an Instagram? Oh, the show doesn't.
We can Google it.
But you can find it on HBO.
We can add this in later.
Or you can just watch it on HBO Max.
There you go.